My name is James Douglas, grave number 284 in Cemetery 1. I died on May 23, 1898. I was admitted to the asylum on August 21, 1895, as patient number 3027. I was born in 1838 in Kentucky and moved to Highland County, Ohio. I served as a private in the Civil War from 1863 to 65 as part of the 1st Regiment of the Ohio Heavy Artillery. When I was brought to the asylum, being locked up wasn't new to me because I'd already been in jail for 2 years.
From WOUB Public Media in Athens, Ohio, you're listening to Who Lies Beneath the Asylum. I'm Sherry Russo. This is a podcast about restoring dignity and respect by giving a voice to the voiceless. Sometimes people ended up at the Athens Asylum because none of the other ways society dealt with those who were deemed difficult seemed to work. James Douglas might have been one of those people. His admission records at the Athens Asylum describe him as single, with no education and no religion. It says his occupation was as a, quote, tramp of unknown disposition and habits, end quote. It went on to say that he was in good health, but had, quote, bad business and domestic relations, and that no one knew what brought on his, quote, attacks onset, but the duration had only been for a short time and became so while he was in the penitentiary. Retired library archivist and asylum cemetery research Doug McCabe joins us now. Doug, we've done so many stories with no details available from admission records. This one seems to have an abundance, but what does that all mean to you?
Well, information on individuals depended on what was provided by doctors and witnesses before a probate judge. Then more can be found out by searching census records, marriage records, military muster files, divorce records, newspapers, death records, and other sources. Sometimes there is a host of information, and other times there's next to nothing. Out of the 1,900 plus people buried at the asylum, there are about 200 I could find nothing much at all.
Wow. Well, what do we know about the Ohio Heavy Artillery that James served with during the Civil War?
Well, the 1st Regiment Ohio Volunteer Heavy Artillery was first organized as the 117th Regiment of Infantry in September of 1862 and converted to an artillery unit in May of 1863. It was involved in operations in Kentucky, Tennessee, Western Virginia, and North Carolina, and the regiment was finally mustered out or disbanded in July of 1865.
Can you explain to me what you think the occupation tramp means?
Well, typically a tramp was a person with no permanent residence, no regular job, a beggar, and often a thief.
Okay, that covers a lot of ground.
Yeah.
How about what does bad business and domestic relations mean?
Well, that reference most likely refers to thievery and violence upon other people.
Okay. What do we know, if anything, about why he was in jail?
Well, James was busted for theft, okay, found guilty, sentenced to 3 years, and put in the Ohio Penitentiary at Columbus.
Was the asylum a place of last resort for courts and prisons when officials couldn't figure out really what to do with someone?
Well, in James's case, when his time was up at the penitentiary, the warden determined that James's mental condition made him not ready to return to the general population and that he would be better served to be placed in the Athens Asylum until he got better. But sadly, James never recovered and spent the rest of his life in the Athens Asylum.
Now it's time to hear from another person buried in the Athens Asylum cemeteries whose admission records indicate was causing problems in society that traditional solutions could not address. Here's William Black's story through a first-person style account with the help of voice actor Tom Russo.
My name is William Black, grave number 516 in Cemetery 1. I was admitted to the asylum as patient number 807 on April 2, 1878, from Monroe County. I was 23 years old at the time. My admission records say I was institutionalized as a result from overstudy. I was born in 1852 to Christopher and Catherine Black. My father was a farmer, and I was one of nine children. Before I was admitted to the asylum, I also worked as a farmer. I was never released from the asylum and died in 1914.
Doug, what does the term overstudy mean to you?
I suppose overstudy means just that, but it's hardly very descriptive of William's condition. Had he severely cut back on eating or sleeping or keeping clean or staying shut up and not interested or interacting with other people? Who knows? It may be that he was just so obsessive in his behavior that he needed to be institutionalized.
Okay. Well, there was a man that we've talked about before who was admitted to the asylum because he was trying to start a labor union in Nelsonville. And I think the term overstudy might have been used there. This kind of feels like that to me. Could this be something similar?
If there's a similarity, I guess you could say it's obsessiveness on the part of these two people. In William's case, it seems like it's his own individual personal problem. Regarding union organizing, you can see that as a threat to company owners and their profits.
Absolutely. Well, according to census records, William's male siblings seem to start working with their dad on the farm as they grew older. Does William's background as part of a large farming family along the Ohio River in the 1870s tell you anything about why William might have been sent to the asylum, never released, and never claimed when he died?
Well, William was at the asylum for over 30 years.
Wow.
That his body was never claimed can be put down to several possibilities. No family could be found, or no family member would pay for bringing him home, or the family was just too ashamed.
Okay. Well, while this podcast focuses on the lives of those who died at the asylum, like William, who were unclaimed by their families, there were many others who were housed at the asylum under questionable circumstances. And thanks to their own writings in an asylum newspaper, we know a little more about them. Joining us now is Nora Steele. She's a Southeast Ohio artist who discovered the asylum and the people who lived there, and also is a listener of this podcast and reached out to let me know some of the work that she's done to learn about people who were not buried at the asylum, but lived at the asylum. Nora, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, I'm really excited about it, Sherry.
Nora, tell me a little bit about how you came to discover the asylum and how you got involved in conducting research.
Okay. It's kind of a long story, but I'll see if I can shorten it for you. So I was actually given the opportunity to photograph part of the inside of the asylum. And so looking through all my photos, I really became interested in some of the things that I saw, you know, some of the rooms that I was in and how these rooms were used. And so I started doing research online, and I printed out all these documents, and it was actually this really nice sunny day, and I'm a naturalist full time, and so that means I spend a lot of time outside, and so I really just wanted to take all this stuff and read it. So I went out to the asylum, and I actually sat on one of the porches of one of the cottages, and I was reading through this information, and just it really came to life. But I came across this newspaper called the Green Hill News, and it's this newspaper that was published periodically by the patients of the asylum from about 1955 through about 1970 or so. And it was just really amazing because while I was sitting there on this porch of this cottage, looking through these photos and reading these newspapers, it was almost as though these words that were written, you know, all these decades ago, just came to life right before me. And so I started researching the patients that had actually written these words, and it just kind of grew from there.
Awesome. So tell me, you kind of zeroed in on three patients that you learned about from reading the Green Hill News. Can you tell us about those patients?
Yes, I'll start with Agnes, because she's really the one that kind of led me into this whole project. So that day that I had printed off all this information, you know, I'm sitting there on this cottage porch and I'm reading through, and I actually have this section in front of me. So this is something that was written in December of 1955 by this woman called Agnes. And I'll go ahead and read this for you. So it says, "As I look out the window while writing, Squeaky, our squirrel, is sitting erect with a hard delicacy revolving in his paws. He's so cute. His little presence changes ordinary trees and grass into a wild woodland of which he is so proud that his tail sticks straight out in agitation. If we are doubtful, he thinks he's nature's baby because he's so playful and harmless, sociable too. Hunger will drive him near any human. And that's where he wears his most piteous and begging expression, makes chattering noises while wagging his tail so violently that it's a wonder it doesn't snap off. When Squeaky is hungry, you know it. He doesn't need words to tell you. He thoroughly dislikes cats. They're always chasing him up a tree. When this happens, he scolds them roundly from a high limb. Of course, the cats enjoy chasing him, but he can never understand his indignant language. So Squeaky has to tell it to the breeze. If only he could put his scolding into words, I bet it would sound extremely interesting." And so I'm sitting there on this porch reading this, and as I'm reading it, of course, you know, we're in southern Appalachia, like southeastern Ohio, there's squirrels everywhere. And so up from just like above my shoulder, I start hearing this chatter. And of course, it's a squirrel. And so it's almost as though her words came to life. And so I was flipping through all my notes and I looked at the map where I was sitting, and it happened to be at the exact same cottage that this woman had written these words from. And so that's really what got me started was Agnes and her story about Squeaky the squirrel. And I hesitate to kind of get into how much research I did with these people, because the Green Hill News is completely censored. Because it's in recent history, all the medical information has been completely cut out of this newspaper. It is first names only. And so it was very, very difficult to find more information on who these people were, because basically all I had was a first name, and possibly if they had, you know, if they happened to remark that they attended the birthday party in the month of January, I knew that they had a January birthday. Or if they had a visit from a family member, you know, they might mention that family member's name. So in researching these people, I actually printed out about 3 years worth of newspapers. And I went through and I documented these people's lives from month to month. And if they happened to mention any personal details, such as birthdays or years or family members, and then using that information, I was able to do more research to figure out who they were. So in Agnes's case, it took me well over a year to actually figure out who she was. She mentioned a January birthday, but not the year that she was born. She mentioned a sister, but the sister had a nickname. And the last name that she mentioned for her sister was actually a misspelling. And so all I had was a sister's name that had been misspelled. And like I said, it took me well over a year, but I ended up typing her into Ancestry.com. So in the search tab, I just put Agnes, didn't have a last name, put a birthday as possibly January, but didn't have a year. and put her sister's name, but instead of a nickname, I kind of theorized and put a longer name there. And I typed in search, and over 200,000 results came up, you know, because it's pretty vague. And how I actually found Agnes was pretty amazing. I just kind of scrolled and picked one, and all the information lined up with the woman that I had been searching. She had the right birthday. She had the right sister. She lived in the right area. She was the right age. And the really thing that kind of nailed her down was the sister's last name was only one letter off from the misspelling that was in this newspaper. And I actually ended up researching more about her, and I found her relatives, and I reached out to relatives that actually knew Agnes, and we were able to connect, and they confirmed that this was a person who had lived at the Athens State Hospital, and she had written all of these things. And it was just pretty amazing that after a year of reading this person's words and wondering about her, I was finally able to connect with family members that had photos and things like that. So I was able to see what she looked like.
Nora, were you able to learn why Agnes was in the asylum?
So I don't have access to the official information, but according to her family, they don't think that she should ever have been in the asylum. We don't know what her official diagnosis was, but we do have some theories. But overall, I think she was just too much for her time. She had a lot of spunk, a lot of personality. She was extremely intelligent. And this is a woman that's basically growing up in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. And so I think at the time she just had too much personality and just didn't fit in. And I don't quite know how she ended up in the asylum. But basically the remarks from her family was is they just don't think she should have ever been there. And when she did leave, they said that she was never the same. She would have entered the hospital in 1954. And the last record that I have of her in the hospital is around 1965, 1966. So it would have been around 11 years that she would have lived there.
Wow. So tell me, you know, the Green Hill News, this seems to me to be a document that can really give such insight into what life was like living in the asylum. You know, tell me what else you've discovered by reading this newspaper.
Oh, it's pretty amazing. So this is a newspaper that I mentioned. It was published for around 15 or so years on and off. And really, the two people that started this newspaper were Agnes and her friend Elizabeth, who we'll actually talk about next. Agnes was actually the one that named this newspaper, the Green Hill News, and I almost think it was like her baby. You know, these patients, they needed a creative outlet while they were there, and she made it for everybody else. This was something that all of the patients could contribute their poems, their news, their writings, anything that was going on that month, they could submit it to the newspaper and it would be published for all the other patients to read as well as some of the staff, and even people around town were able to access the newspaper as well. They talk about the local sheriff and things like that received a publication and enjoyed reading it. So it was really just a way for the patients to kind of communicate in between wards. And also the hospital's press club, they would have met once a month. And the patients that were part of the press club were the ones that really went around the hospital to help collect news. And it was really just a way to kind of bring them back into society and make these patients, you know, a little bit more sociable and give them kind of a creative outlet.
So tell us about Elizabeth then.
So Elizabeth is the one that I believe kept the newspaper running. I have a timeline of Elizabeth's time in the hospital, and it matches up perfectly with the creation of the Green Hill News. And in fact, when Elizabeth leaves the hospital in 1969, the Green Hill News is not published again for a year. And when it is, it comes back only on a periodic basis. It's not really published, you know, once a month like it was before. It doesn't have the same creativity. And I really think it was Elizabeth that was keeping this newspaper going. And Elizabeth really has quite the backstory. She was born in 1908 in Portsmouth. And for the first part of her life, she's incredibly, incredibly intelligent. And she actually works as a secretary for a local congressman down in Portsmouth. And she works with him for about 5 years or so. In the year after he resigns from office, she's admitted to the Athens State Hospital. And she actually lives in the hospital, I think, for about another 20 or so years after that. She arrives in 1948, and she doesn't leave until 1969. And while she was there, Elizabeth was really seen as the model patient. I don't know what she was admitted for. I have a theory that it has something to do with this life change. You know, she was the secretary for this congressman. She's throwing parties when he's not around. She's I even found documentation that she won some letter writing contests, and basically she's held in high esteem. And as soon as he's no longer in office, she's admitted to the hospital. So I think there's something to do with that there, but I don't know why she stayed for so long. But while she was there, she basically had free access to walk around the hospital as she pleased. She could go to town as she wanted to do. She could shop in town, go to church services. There were doctors that traveled from around the country, and when they came to the hospital, for some reason, they would meet with Elizabeth to talk to her. And she would go to other wards to put on puppet shows or to sing. And really, she was just kind of like the star patient, and she really made the hospital her home. While she was there, she started the press club. She was the first president of the press club, and she was one of the founding reporters for this Green Hill News. And like I mentioned before, I think without her, there wouldn't have been a hospital newspaper to begin with, because she really just seemed to be the driving force behind a lot of these creative endeavors that were brought about in the 1950s.
Nora, you said that this Green Hill News wasn't only something for the people at the Athens Asylum to read, but it was exchanged with other asylums, correct? And like other asylums sent their newspapers to Athens?
Yes. I did find documentation that this Green Hill News was exchanged with other state hospitals as well. And periodically, if a patient would find something published in one of the other asylum's newspapers that they liked, they would publish it in the Green Hill News as well. I have a couple of favorites that are actually not from Athens at all, but from, you know, Weston State Hospital or Bryce State as well.
All right. So tell us about the third person that you've done a lot of digging into.
Okay. Well, the third is going to take the most explaining, because he is the most tricky and most confusing of the three patients. His name is Benjamin Franklin, and last name, but I'm not going to include that, but he is the Bard of the Hocking Hills. So I'll start with the very beginning. This is not where I met Ben, but we'll start where he kind of starts off. So he was born in Meigs County, but he lived most of his life in Nelsonville, which is fairly close to Athens. His entire family lived in basically a one-bedroom house on Chestnut Street in Nelsonville. And by entire family, I mean his mother, his father, and all 10 children. And basically, all his life, the only thing that Ben knew was poverty. And that's repeated over and over in everything that I've read about him, is the family never had enough money. They were constantly being hounded by officials, and it just seemed like they were always down on their luck. But that didn't really seem to set Ben back very much. While he was in the hospital, he was known as the man who was an institution within an institution. And it seemed like he was almost, just like Agnes, too much for his time. When he lived in Nelsonville, he worked as a stationary engineer for the Hocking Valley Railroad. And he always chose to work the graveyard shift. So he would be working in the middle of the night. And even though he had seniority and he could choose to work at any time of the day, he chose to work the middle of the night because the work was light, and working in the dark gave him the creativity to write down his poems. And so how I was really introduced to Ben was through his poetry. And I'm going to go ahead and read one of these for you before we kind of get into a little bit more about Ben. So this is the poem that really captured my attention and really wanted me to make, you know, more like really research him a little bit more. So this is called The Song of the Hocking Hills, and it would have been written around April of 1955. So sing me a song of the Hocking Hills, where shadow and sunlight play, a song of wind and lofty trees, and a tinkle of many rills. There are some who will sing a song of the plains, others a song of the sea. Everyone sings a song of home, a song that each heart thrills. But when I am lonely and far from friends, then sing me a song of the hills. So Ben was a poet. And while he lived in Nelsonville, he called himself the Bard of the Hocking Hills. And he entered the Athens State Hospital following the death of his mother. So he had been living at home alone with his mother for most of his life. And intermittently, his siblings would move in and out depending on the financial situation. And he would make a little bit of extra pocket money by going around Nelsonville and sharpening people's knives, or he even would print some of his poems on little 5-cent cards and sell those around town as well. And I found documentation that he had many physical deformities, and that kept him from ever finding a wife and getting married or even living on his own. It seemed that he lived at his house with his mother for his entire life. So as soon as she died, he couldn't afford to live there on his own, and he entered the Athens State Hospital the same year. And at that point, he starts referring to himself as the Bard of Ward 14, and also amusingly, the Bard of Krausmeyer's Alley. And it was actually through the Bard of Krausmeyer's Alley is how I was able to find Ben. So in doing more research, I went to the Athens Messenger. And just looking at different records online, I ended up doing a search of Krausmeyer. And it ended up bringing me to Ben's last name, because not only was he publishing poems in the Green Hill News, the Athens News, or the Asylum newspaper, he was also publishing them in the Athens Messenger, because he had a friend who was a local reporter. And so he and the local reporter would send poems and letters back and forth, and the letters from Ben would be published in the Athens newspaper, the Athens Messenger. So I actually have quite a bit of information about Ben and his backstory just from things that were published by his friend. And amazingly, they're in his own words as well, because they had several interviews between them. But it's quite funny, because it took me so long to find him, because all through the Green Hill News, Benjamin is going by the name of Ben with the middle initial T, Ben T. And his actual name is Benjamin Franklin. And so you'd think that his middle initial would be F. But I know for a fact that it's him because I found the same poems, you know, published in this other newspaper, and I can confirm it's the same person. And so I started wondering, you know, why would he have changed his middle initial? And I finally realized it goes back to those physical deformities. Over and over again, they talk about Ben's bad back. And so I think he was actually making a joke the entire time about how he was Ben T. He's bent. And I just thought that was really amusing. He tricked me for the longest time. And after I figured out he was using a little bit of an alias to write his poems as Ben T, I started doing a little bit more research, and I found out that he uses several other aliases as well. And so it's taken me quite a bit of time to go through the Green Hill News and kind of piece together all the different poems and snippets that I believe are actually written by Ben. For instance, he would send poems to the Green Hill News under names such as Abe Lincoln, Henry W. Shortfellow, Chet, Ella Wheeler Wilcox, Chester, and Emerson. And so I've actually contacted some of the local researchers that handle the Green Hill News, and they're going to be going through some of those records in figuring out which ones of these are actual patient records that may have actually submitted things, and which of these, you know, like Abe Lincoln, obviously didn't go to the asylum and are probably just things that Ben would have submitted.
That's amazing. So Nora, you know, I mean, you've obviously spent a lot of time doing this research. So tell me, you know, what has drawn you to this so much that you have felt the need to track this down and just kind of figure out the life stories of these people?
It's hard to say. They just seem to come alive to me as I write about them. The more I find out, the more they seem like, I'm trying to think of exactly how to put this, and you can edit this as you want. It's the biggest question I always get about the asylum is it haunted? You know, it's the first thing people want to know. And I guess I want people to realize there's more to the Athens State Hospital than just ghosts. You know, these are actual real people with real lives and real backstories, and you should treat them that way. And the more you find out about them, the more amazing the people are than the stories that you could actually make up about them. And so I guess I'm just trying to change the narrative a bit, because I just think there's so much stigma against, you know, like paranormal and things like that. And I don't want people to get that idea from this place, I guess. And it's the first thing when you do a Google search is it haunted or the ghosts of Athens? And I guess I could just kind of want to change that stigma a bit.
Sounds like we're trying to do the same thing, just with the different sets of people. Because I think it's interesting that, you know, we're really focused on the people that are buried there, that are buried under numbers, and you're really just looking into the people who lived there, whether they were buried there or not, and what their life was like while they lived there.
Yeah, I'd like to tell their stories the way that they would have wanted them told. And so some of the things that I'll do is I'll take their words, the things that they wrote in the Green Hill News, and then I take the photographs that I took while I was given the tour of the asylum. And as an artist, I draw details into those photos using things that they wrote. So for instance, they might talk about a Valentine's Day party, and I'll draw some of those details into these photos now that I know where these events took place. And so I'm hoping to kind of publish a book at some point with all of those things in one place.
Wow, it's an amazing, amazing use of your talent as an artist to bring these stories to life. Nora, thank you so much for sharing those stories. We really appreciate you taking the time to be here, and please keep us up to date on your research and all the amazing things that you're doing.
I will, of course.
Now joining us is Lisa Skeens, who is an associate professor of social work at Ohio University and is a therapist. A few of her specialty areas are anxiety disorders, grief, and PTSD. Lisa, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lisa, when you hear these stories of the people Nora talked about, or that James's occupation was listed as a tramp and he was basically transferred from the jail to the asylum, and William was admitted due to, quote, overstudy, what are your thoughts?
Yes, there certainly is a lot to unpack here with these cases and the very ambiguous diagnoses that we hear. You know, when the first one about the overstudy, that one is very interesting, because if you look at some of the criteria for admission into the asylums during that time, there were so many very unique criteria for it. So in looking at that, I mean, there were actually categories for people to be institutionalized around becoming too interested in a topic, whether it was religion, or there was one called novel reading, which was viewed as just becoming too intense about a particular subject. So, you know, it's hard to tell if this particular individual was looking to advocate or to start a movement of some kind and he was silenced, or perhaps he was more intellectual. And I know during that time, especially with the farming background that was discussed, made me wonder too if he was sort of viewed as not as helpful or useful and marginalized in that way. So that was one of my thoughts. And also just looking at the diagnostic criteria of that, you know, and looking at some of these different reasons people were admitted, they really don't even make sense, because they're sort of all over the place. You know, some are actually symptoms, which we could define now as depressive mood disorder or affective disorders, but others were just behaviors, you know, such as, you know, having an overinterest in something. There was one sometimes being deserted by a partner, having different medical issues, having a menstrual cycle, menopause, all those sorts of things. So even the criteria was very interesting to try to assess.
Do you think the word, like, James's occupation was listed as a tramp? I mean, the only thing I can come up with for that is the very, like, inappropriate definition of tramp. So what do you think of that when you see that?
Yeah, you know, if I recall, he is the gentleman who was released from prison. Mm-hmm. During that time, when we look historically, there was a lot of overlap of individuals who were incarcerated and the start of the institutions, which started around, you know, the mid-1800s or so. So I think it's hard to tell if that meant that, you know, it was viewed as a deviant behavior, whether it was sort of a transient type of individual, or whether he was viewed as lazy. That was another area. Or, you know, again, having criminal history, but we don't really know what the criminal history was. So during that time, again, there was a lot of overlap where there were people transitioning back and forth from the institutions, from prisons. And I think the problems were quite similar and mysterious for people that didn't understand it.
So when we look at the history of treating mental illness, you know, I think what you're saying is that asylums were used to manage those who were considered troublemakers in society. Am I right about that?
It does look like there were some cases that were that were utilized that way, that people may not have had a clear diagnosis, or the prisons were overcrowded. And, you know, we also have to understand, just like the institutions, the prisons at that time also had inhumane conditions, which contributed to trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder. So overcrowding and disease and violence and untreated mental illness, all of those things. So sometimes it's even interesting to look at what came first, the chicken or the egg there, you know, with which symptoms were surfacing. But yes, it did appear that that could have been the case.
So how have we grown, you know, in that respect?
Yeah, well, I think, thank goodness, we've made progress in those areas. But as far as diagnostic confusion, there are groups of people, of course, in society who are still at risk for not obtaining a thorough or appropriate diagnosis and not having accessibility to treatment. And sometimes we see that with folks who are not able to have private insurance. They may be either non-insured or they have Medicaid and the waiting lists are longer to see practitioners. So sometimes even the lack of accessibility is very oppressive, because when the acute symptoms are there, people are not able to get the treatment they need during those moments.
Do you think we still improperly slap a mentally ill or insane label on people that we just don't know how to deal with?
I think that does happen sometimes. There are some disorders that are frequently misdiagnosed. For example, bipolar disorder is many times misdiagnosed for unipolar disorder, or what others may consider, you know, major depressive disorder. And in those situations, we know for a fact that people in prison have a much higher prevalence, three times higher than those who are not incarcerated, of having major mental illnesses such as bipolar disorder. And that's one that is misunderstood. So someone may have a manic episode, for example, and be impulsive or loud in public, and then they get arrested and there's not a thorough mental health assessment, and then they're incarcerated, for example. So things of that nature. Also, when we look at youth and children, there's also concerns. You know, we sometimes hear the expression, sort of the pipeline from school to prison with some children of color, children with disabilities, the LGBT population of children who are misunderstood and are severely punished for what we might consider minor behavioral problems and sent directly to the juvenile detention center, where, you know, hopefully they're getting mental health assessment, but sometimes that's not what they need at the moment. So that can start actually earlier in life.
All right, Lisa. Well, thank you so much for your insight into this. We really appreciate your time.
Sure. Thank you.
My name is James Douglas.
And my name is William Black.
Now we turn to you. We want to hear your stories about long-lost relatives in your families who you believe may be buried under a numbered tombstone or at an unmarked cemetery across the country. We'd love to share your story and see if the work done here in Athens might lead you to some answers and maybe even a name on their grave marker. Email us at wholiesbeneath@woub.org. Thanks for listening, and until next time, take care of each other. Who Lies Beneath the Asylum is a production of WOUB Public Media in Athens, Ohio. Written by me, Sherry Russo. Adam Rich is our audio engineer. Artwork by Sean Anderson. Special thanks to Doug McCabe and Lisa Skeens for contributing their knowledge and voices to this podcast, and Rusty Smith and Tom Russo for their work as the voices of James Douglas and William Black. If you like the show, please rate and subscribe, or visit woub.org to learn more.